when it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tortoise. Hello, it's Basha here, and you're listening to the Slow Newscast from Tortoise. Now, there are moments in every country when you can feel the political mood harden into something specific. And we've known for a while, since the previous Conservative government under Boris Johnson, that the small boats crisis, the number of migrants and asylum seekers arriving on Britain's shores, was going to be a key political issue. But it wasn't until a new plan was announced, the Rwanda deal, that a new frontline in British politics locked into place. There's been much reporting in the British press about how and why Rwanda, but in this week's Slow Newscast, my colleagues Will Brown, Patricia Clark and Rebecca Moore investigate the cost of such a deal to Rwandans, to freedom of speech and to our principles. And they start with the mysterious death of a journalist just weeks ago.
It's an honour to be back in Rwanda, and I want to put on record my deep thanks to you personally and your officials for the incredibly constructive partnership that we have secured.
Last month, the British Home Secretary, Suella Braverman, flew to Kigali, the capital of Rwanda. She was there to sell the small East African nation as a solution to a problem. A problem that had become urgent and was now at the top of her Conservative government's agenda, the small boats crisis.
The British people deserve to know which party is serious about stopping the invasion on our southern coast and which party is not.
That's how her government was characterising the surge in the number of asylum seekers and migrants arriving on Britain's shores in inflatable dinghies, from countries like Iran, Afghanistan and Albania. Migrant detention centres were in disarray, full and facing outbreaks of disease. Politicians were angry about asylum seekers being housed in expensive hotels. The system was broken. And Rwanda, we were being told, was the solution. You might have seen a picture of Suella Braverman that went viral online. She's standing in front of a new detention centre in Kigali, where she hopes to send Britain's asylum seekers. Her head is thrown back in a hearty laugh. She looks elated.
I sincerely believe that this world-leading partnership between two allies and two friends, United Kingdom and Rwanda, will lead the way in finding a solution which is both humanitarian and compassionate. There is a real opportunity here to resettle people in safe and secure environments.
But a few weeks before the Home Secretary landed, just a couple of miles from the new detention centre, something happened. Something that reveals a side of Rwanda that the UK government does not want the British public to see. A side that flies in the face of any notion that the country is safe or compassionate. This is John Williams Twali, a renowned journalist who had been covering Rwanda for decades. He was a rarity, one of the few local journalists who dared to go up against the 30-year regime of the Rwandan president, a man called Paul Kagame.
I'm focused on justice, human rights, and advocacy. And I know all those three areas are risky here in Rwanda, but I'm committed to.
John reported on corruption, torture and lies, the bulldozing of poorer neighbourhoods and the court trials of other journalists like him who dare to go against official narratives.
He was a fierce guy and he didn't fear anyone. But the kind of work that he was doing, I had really no doubt that he's going to be in trouble.
In January, John died. He was 44 years old. The Rwandan authorities say it was a car crash in the middle of the night near the city centre. But the people who knew John and have worked in the country have their doubts. They think it's unlikely it was an accident. In his last international interview, John spoke out about the dangers of being a journalist in his country.
Those who try to speak out, they are jailed, harassed, intimidated or jailed. Second, forced to flee the country. Three, some of them disappear in a thin air, or even they die.
I'm Will Brown, and you're listening to the Slow Newscast from Tortoise. The sudden death of a Rwandan journalist, John Williams Twali, went largely ignored in the UK, particularly by our politicians. But his death tells us everything we need to know about our relationship with our friends and allies in Rwanda. What is the UK government prepared to look away from to get this policy through?
They also made it clear that if I don't leave, it's most likely that I'm going to be eliminated. People don't forgive and they don't forget. That's the nature of my country.
No one is aspiring to become a journalist to become rich in Rwanda. They're doing it out of real love for the trade and a real love to ask difficult questions, hold leaders accountable. That's hard to do in any context in this day and age, but it's particularly hard in Rwanda.
This is Louis Mudge, Central Africa Director at the NGO Human Rights Watch. Louis was based in Kigali, and he spoke regularly to John Williams Twali.
I'll always remember him as someone with a microphone talking to very poor people living in these, what some people refer to as slums, in Kigali, and really giving them a voice to explain why they didn't want to be forced out of their homes and why they felt they had a right to stay there.
Louis is not allowed back to Rwanda anymore. He was kicked out. In fact, he's the third Human Rights Watch researcher to be expelled for criticising the government since 2008. Rwanda is not an easy place to work. The defining moment in the country's history came in 1994, when decades of divide-and-rule tactics among the country's two main ethnicities, the Hutu majority and the Tutsi minority, descended into genocide. It was a slaughter on an unimaginable scale. Hutu extremists had been told that Tutsis were little better than cockroaches and were to be eliminated like pests. Around 800,000 Tutsis and moderate Hutus were massacred over 100 days with clubs, guns and machetes.
We're exposed to death every day and night. It's a desperation I read on all the faces here.
A calamity of such epic proportions, so massive in size and scope, the truth of it is far beyond journalism's reach.
From the ashes, Rwanda seemed to mount an extraordinary recovery, on the outside, at least. Nearly 30 years later, in the capital, everything feels big and shiny and new. Wide litter-free streets, towering offices, with a network of buses that run like clockwork, and a parliament where over 60% of the MPs are women. The country has become a darling of the international community. It's held up as a shining example of what billions of dollars of Western aid money can do. But there are things you simply can't touch as a journalist. You cannot criticise senior officials. You cannot write about corruption or abuses by the regime. But John was the editor of a news outlet called The Chronicles, and the news website's heading says it all: serving your right to know the truth. He also had a YouTube channel called Pax TV, which broadcast reports in the local Kinyarwanda language. He said this was where he could do his boldest reporting.
Of course, if one works with a TV or a radio station here in Rwanda, it's easy to interfere them, to cancel them, or to even censor what they have been doing.
In those videos, he'd often be reporting in his characteristic frameless glasses and small goatee. His channel got about 2 million hits a year, an impressive audience considering there are only about 50 million Kinyarwanda speakers in the world. Friends tell me that John was motivated to be a journalist because of the genocide. He wanted to hold the powerful to account, to make sure people could never be manipulated in the same way again.
The man actually who used to be the husband to my auntie is the one who killed her, and he killed also his kids, two children, because he believed that they have Tutsi blood in them. And he killed them anyway. Yeah, so that's the whole background. That's the whole pain of the country. That's the country that's part of our history as Rwandans. So growing up in this kind of environment, you really want to do something that can change the history.
This is Fred Mavunyi, another Rwandan journalist and a friend of John's. John and Fred both thought that journalism was the thing they could do to help.
There were certain areas of media that people couldn't dare go to, and that was politics and human rights. He was a journalist already, and one of those fearless journalists that we had at the time. We struggled. We faced, I mean, I've been arrested God knows how many times in Rwanda, all intimidated by security organs because you're trying to pushing the limits. We walk along the edge knowing that any time, you know, it could go south and it's over.
But John found a way to cope with the constant threats he faced.
He was a funny guy. He used to tell jokes and even difficult ones, like getting killed. John would still find words to make those words even smooth and funnier. You feel like, you know, you're just doing this, you're in danger, but it's okay. You know, this is the world we live in. He was professional as a human being, of course. I mean, he was so friendly. Every time I wanted to talk to him, I could find him. He was never too busy to have time for me.
It's clear, though, that John had a keen sense of the line he was walking.
I had really no doubt that he's going to be in trouble. I had no doubt that he's going to be in trouble. Not just what I saw in the media, being threatened that he will be eliminated.
Eliminated. It really strikes me to hear Fred say that word, to use the language of the genocide 30 years later.
He had been threatened on numerous occasions before his death. He was told face to face by people who said they were intelligence agents that he had to stop being so critical, that, quote, why can't you focus on the good things that are happening in this country?
The Rwandan authorities say that John died in a motorbike accident on an unidentified road near the centre of Kigali at around 2:50 a.m. on January 18th. In the few details released, they say a speeding car hit the motorbike from behind, knocking John to the ground. But the other details are sketchy. Nothing about the case seems to add up.
In Rwanda, if you are deemed as critical, there is, curiously, the odds of you having an accident go up. The only way for John, like, his future was pretty defined and delineated. It was either, like, shut up and cross your fingers, leave the country, get arrested, or have an accident.
Shortly before his death, John told his friends he was terrified. One person told me he was too scared to leave the house after dark or to use a motorbike taxi. So why did he end up on a motorbike taxi in the dead of night? Then, while John apparently died immediately of his wounds, the driver walked away with only a mild shoulder injury. A trial was held, with no independent observers or journalists present. The road where he supposedly died was named, but their exact location was not.
This is Kigali. I mean, I think a lot of people might, who aren't familiar with Central Africa or Rwanda, might think that this is a very third world poor city. It's not. You know, Kigali has CCTV cameras all over the city. This is a city that's very, very well surveilled. And to have had an accident involving someone of this profile happen under shady circumstances, and then to have had this closed door trial in which nothing about the actual circumstances of his death has come out, frankly, for folks like myself, only leads to more questions than answers.
A medical report was vaguely referenced in the verdict, but the details about who carried out the autopsy and the report into his death have not been released. John is not the only Rwandan to be targeted for not towing the line. In 2021, a YouTuber was jailed for humiliating state officials, a journalist was charged with disseminating propaganda, and a university lecturer imprisoned after posting critical videos online. John Williams Twali's death means that one of the last critical voices in Rwanda is gone. We don't know how he died, but his death feels to Fred and to others like a message. Fred knows the ins and outs of the whole system. He used to run the Rwanda Media Commission, a group campaigning for more independent media, which has now ceased to exist.
I've received threats, death threats as well. I've had the police here also investigating people, chasing me. Every time I did my job as a journalist, some of the government people, including ministers and some of the from the intelligence services, they were not happy. And there were plans to have me arrested. And then they were also, when the arrest was not probably the best idea, they were talking about how to eliminate me.
There's that word again, eliminate. Fred worked with that word hanging over his head for years. John and Fred had parallel lives until one crucial moment, a decision to leave or stay. That happened in 2014. The BBC aired a documentary questioning their official narrative around the genocide. President Paul Kagame disagreed with their line and tried to ban the BBC from Rwanda. Fred Mavunyi stood up to the government on the issue. That was when, according to his account, he found out through security contacts that there was a plan to eliminate him. He decided to flee his home in the middle of the night and run for his life across the border into Uganda.
I was like, okay, this is going beyond the usual threats. This is serious. And they also made it clear that if I don't leave, it's most likely that I'm going to be eliminated.
But while he got away with his life, in exile, he lost everything.
I left my son, I left my family, my parents, my siblings. So I only left alone, so on my own. And since then, I've never went back. I've lost relatives that I never had a chance to say goodbye to them who died. My son was 6 years when I left, and now he's turning 14. I'm not in his life in a practical way or emotional way, and he's not in mine. Then I've also left the media fraternity that I worked for. Some of them have died, others have been killed, detained. So the culture, everything that forms a human being and makes us who we are, I left them. You know, I left them. I don't have them. I don't have my son. I don't have the community that I deserve to have. So I left everything. In one word, I left everything. I have nothing.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince, they exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
This country, the country Fred Mavunyi fled 8 years ago, where John Williams Twali died in suspicious circumstances 2 months ago, is the same country British politicians are praising as a tolerant and compassionate haven. This is the same country the UK is now paying £140 million to house asylum seekers, and more UK tax money is on the way.
Working with our friends in Rwanda, the people who come here will be resettled to live a safe and secure life. That's the humane approach, and that's the compassionate approach.
The deal was announced in April 2022. It goes like this. Until at least 2027, Britain gets to send several hundred people a year to Rwanda for processing, asylum and resettlement. The Conservative Party gets to say it's being tough on migration to its voter base. Rwanda gets a big pot of cash, legitimacy, political capital, and the backing of a permanent member of the UN Security Council. But since it was announced nearly a year ago, not a single plane has taken off with an asylum seeker on board because of legal wranglings in the UK High Court. But that hasn't stopped this government's investment in the plan.
I've been incredibly impressed with my visit today, both to meet local innovators and entrepreneurs and to see the job creation and the wealth creation going on in the vibrant economy of Rwanda, but also to the Buiza estate and to see the extensive construction work which is being rolled out, some of which will be used for the resettlement and integration of migrants.
But there have been plenty of criticisms. The Archbishop of Canterbury has described the plan as ungodly, and human rights activists say it tears up the very refugee conventions that Britain helped to forge after the Holocaust. But this is what I can't understand. How can the government say this is a safe country for asylum seekers, who are often political dissidents themselves, when they are more than aware of what's happening to people like John and Fred?
Hi, how are you doing?
Hi, all right. Hi.
I've come to meet Michaela Wrong.
I love your masks.
Yeah, they're from Congo. The nice ones, the big ones.
Yeah,
these are from Rwanda, obviously.
The walls in her apartment are lined with books about Africa, as well as masks and wooden sculptures. She's collected them all over her 30 years travelling back and forth to the continent as a writer and reporter. Michaela was there in Rwanda in 1994, reporting on the genocide.
There's always been a love-in between British politicians and Kagame ever since the genocide. There was a feeling of tremendous guilt that we hadn't been there, the international community hadn't been there to stop the genocide in its tracks. And so there was a feeling of, oh my goodness, we did nothing, now we must make up for it.
Since the genocide, the UK has sent hundreds of millions of pounds in aid to Rwanda. And a recipient of all that attention, goodwill and money was President Paul Kagame, a former intelligence officer from the Tutsi minority background. He led the guerrilla rebels, known as the Rwandan Patriotic Front, into the country to end the killing back in 1994. He's been in office since then for almost 30 years, and he has a golden reputation in the UK. Paul Kagame was the man who pulled Rwanda out of the abyss and built a thriving economy out of the ruins.
Rwanda's undergone the most traumatic time, obviously, because of the genocide that was here. It's then rebuilt itself as a country. Britain, when I was Prime Minister, played a significant part in helping that process. And the President of Rwanda is someone I've got a lot of respect for, a lot of time for, and I think he has got a vision for the country now.
There's no doubt that Paul Kagame is a titan of African history. However, Mikella Wrong says the West has been naive about his regime.
Rwanda is this miracle country. It's got incredible growth rates. It's the cleanest place in Africa. It's the Switzerland of Africa. There's no rubbish on the ground. There are no plastic bags in the street, even cigarette butts.
She has heard the stereotypes countless times, but she says it obscures the truth.
The more critical stuff like, well, yes, but it doesn't have a free press. Look where its opposition leaders are. What about all these assassinations? What about all this intimidation? What about all these people who are in jail or who fled the country? None of that really seems to have any traction because you just see the same old stereotypes being rolled out every time his name is mentioned.
The Rwandan authorities claim that Paul Kagame won 99% of the vote in 2017. The one before that was 97%. Before that, it was 99% again. There is no doubt that the president is popular in Rwanda, but a system of oppression at home and abroad, which has seen the regime's opponents end up dead or behind bars, has allowed the government to control the narrative. Rwanda sells itself at the International Monetary Fund and at investors' conferences in Western capitals as an economic miracle. On paper, it looks like the aid that the UK and others in the West sent after the genocide really worked. It's a feel-good story for everyone giving cash.
If you really want to check this economy's pulse, the bustling streets of downtown Kigali are a good place to start. A far cry from the ruined city it was.
The Rwandan government claims that its economy has expanded by around 8% a year for more than a decade, that poverty has declined sharply because of state programs. Mikella Wrong isn't so sure.
I think what I often say to people is, if you are dealing with a dictatorship, you should regard every statistic that comes out of a dictatorship as inherently suspect.
While there has been extraordinary progress since 1994, the brutal source of much of Kigali's wealth is plain to see just a few hours' drive across the border in the Democratic Republic of Congo. DRC has huge mineral reserves, but many of the mines in the east are run by Rwandan-controlled militias. Rebel fighters from one particular group, called M23, have wreaked havoc across the region for more than a year, forcing about 600,000 of the poorest people on earth to flee their homes. Rwanda denies any involvement, but the United Nations experts and the US have condemned it for supporting and arming M23 rebels. When something similar happened in 2012, Britain condemned Rwanda and cut off aid money until it withdrew its militias. A decade on, it's a different story. Now, the UK is turning to Rwanda.
I would love to be having a front page of the Telegraph with a plane taking off to Rwanda. That's my dream.
And now, a journalist is dead. But rather than respond with strong condemnation and call for proper investigation into what happened to John Williams Twali, the British government has sent one of its top politicians to extol the virtues of the Rwandan regime.
Rwanda is dynamic. Rwanda is welcoming. Rwanda has a tradition of providing humanitarian support of a high quality, and the housing project that we visited.
That story that Mikella Wrong mentioned, the one of Rwanda as a plucky country fighting to recover from the genocide. It was carefully created by Paul Kagame, and it's been honed over the years.
I was trying to bring to the attention of everybody the importance of being together as a nation. At the end of the day, we have to bring our energies together for the common good of the country instead of breaking it apart, as we have already experienced. So we've learned lessons from that. It isn't just a story we are told, it's also a life we have lived.
And UK politicians? Well, ever since New Labour in the 90s, they've been drinking the Kool-Aid. But this fascination with Paul Kagame's Rwanda was supercharged when the Conservative Party took over in 2010. One man who is key to understanding this is Andrew Mitchell, a senior Conservative MP who currently serves as Foreign Office Minister for Development and Africa. He's been an ardent fan of Kagame for years, repeatedly defending the regime.
The truth is that President Kagame rescued his country while the world looked the other way and has built a stable and strong state. This is a country that was destroyed by violence, where neighbour killed neighbour, and he's stopped that. He's built an economy that is strong. Virtually all children now go to school in Rwanda, and as I say, huge numbers have been lifted out of poverty.
He's been taking almost £40,000 a year in consultancy fees from Southbridge, a Rwandan investment bank, for 9 days' work. Southbridge is run by Paul Kagame's old right-hand man and finance minister. Andrew Mitchell says he stopped taking money from the bank when he rejoined government in October, but a senior British diplomat working on Africa once described him to me as Rwanda's man in Parliament. We asked Andrew Mitchell to discuss why he took tens of thousands of pounds every year from a man so clearly linked to an authoritarian regime. He declined to speak, but he did issue the following statement.
My close friendship with this remarkable country, which has some of the best development outcomes in the world, enables me to have frank discussions on all matters and support the development, economic and security interests we jointly share. It is slightly disappointing that the success story of aid and development in Rwanda isn't more worthy of your scrutiny.
He also set up Project Umubanu, a charity which took various Conservative MPs out to Rwanda.
And of course, anyone who does that and goes to Rwanda and is then immediately taken to the genocide memorial sites and goes to see the guerrillas and bonds with the people that they're working with, they come back and they have swallowed the narrative. They have swallowed the Rwandan government's line on what happened in the past. So Project Umubanu has been a great way of propagating the RPF narrative to the Conservative Party.
One of those starry-eyed political tourists was then Conservative election candidate and former barrister Suella Braverman.
I'm pleased to welcome the Home Secretary to Rwanda, and I should say, back to Rwanda, because you have been here some years ago in another capacity.
The woman who would become Home Secretary travelled to the country in 2008 and 2010, and later co-founded a charity that cooperated with the government in Kigali and trained lawyers now working inside Rwanda's justice ministry. More than a dozen serving and future MPs were on the same trip as Braverman in 2008, including the second most powerful man in government today, Chancellor Jeremy Hunt. Thanks to Andrew Mitchell's efforts, Rwanda's image was set. The country was a partner, an easy win, a good news story. And so, more than a decade on, here we are.
There is a real opportunity here to resettle people in safe and secure environments where they can lead a prosperous and healthy life.
We've done a lot of work at Tortoise to understand how the asylum deal with Rwanda came about. My colleagues produced an episode of this podcast called Hostile Environment that went inside the Home Office to understand the deal. What they found was not a carefully designed plan. Rwanda was one of dozens of countries that the UK approached, but it was the only one which agreed.
We have just had a good meeting where we discussed our migration and economic development partnership. These innovative partnerships.
Looking back over the decade of interactions between senior Conservative Party members and the Kagame government, it comes as no surprise that when Rwanda said it was willing, the UK received it favourably.
Kagame, he knows what he's doing. I mean, that's a political transaction. You know, they he does them a favor, they do him a favor in one way or the other. They won't criticize him, they won't criticize his policies. So that's how it works, and that's terrible, unfortunately.
A fundamental part of Paul Kagame's staying power is his army of PR-savvy officials. Their attack lines are well-rehearsed and designed to play on Western guilt.
This relationship that we're getting into with the UK, this migration and economic development partnership, is going to be resourced. Well, resourced, there's a lot of opportunity in Rwanda.
This is government spokesperson Yolande Mokolo speaking to Channel 4 News in 2021. She says arguments against the deal stem from racist colonial attitudes and that critics of the Rwandan government are looking down at a system that broadly works.
Rwanda is not the UK. It's not the US. Even these countries have their own issues. We're all working to unite our people. We're not going to mimic a system of government that is also imperfect. We have a system that works for us.
Some of Yolande Mokolo's language might sound familiar. It's a narrative that's been repeated by Suella Braverman and the Conservative Party over and over again.
I think there has been far too much prejudice, frankly, snobbery amongst the critics, who most of whom haven't even visited Rwanda.
What this carefully constructed narrative doesn't include is the death of John Williams Tuale. It doesn't include the pattern of death, torture and exile at the hands of the Rwandan regime. So why is the UK parroting the line of a dictatorship?
You'll forgive me because I'm really emotional on this. Maybe I won't even make sense about what I'm saying. But I see this as another sort of slave trade. like this transaction between the UK and Rwanda, the amount of money the UK government is giving to Rwanda to take human beings, to take care of human beings. Yeah? So that itself kills me. To the core, that it's not acceptable in 21st century. I think Kagame was recent. He was right. One journalist did ask him about this issue and how the human rights record in Rwanda is so terrible, and Kagame responded, "But you guys, who are you to?" Actually, question this. Who are you to even teach me about human rights? Because you have no respect of human rights. As an example, you're shipping people who are running to you, you're shipping them to me.
Fred Mavunye knows better than anyone else what it's like to flee your home and leave everything and everyone you love behind. He still waits in exile in the hope that he'll see his family again. But this asylum deal isn't actually about people like him. It's not about finding a compassionate solution for asylum seekers. And it's not about safe havens.
There's a deal being done, which is we will send you our unwanted refugees. You will process them for a price, 140 million so far, but it's going to be much more than that. We are not going to make the slightest fuss. You know, journalists can die in the most questionable circumstances and we will say nothing. You know, you're proposing to send refugees who might then have some issues with the authorities to a country where journalists are routinely being jailed for doing their job and in the worst instances are dying in completely suspect circumstances and you're okay with that.
Even though it's getting more expensive, it's likely the Rwanda asylum deal may eventually come to nothing. Not a single plane has taken off, and they won't anytime soon because asylum seekers are appealing the decision to send them away. But the deal is done. Both sides have what they want. The Conservative Party can tell their voters they're being tough on migrants crossing the channel, and they'll blame the courts if it fails. And Paul Kagame has won legitimacy on the international stage and the silence of the United Kingdom. That final interview from John.
Those who try to speak out, they are jailed, harassed, intimidated or jailed. Second, forced to flee the country. Three, some of them disappear in a thin air, or even they die.
It now sounds like a message from beyond the grave. This episode was reported by me, Will Brown. It was co-written and produced by Patricia Clark and Rebecca Moore. The sound design was by Tom Birchall, and the editor was Basha Cummings. Become a Tortoise member for just £60 a year to receive early and ad-free access to all our award-winning audio journalism, plus tickets to live events, newsletters, and more. Just go to tortoisemedia.com/slowdown today.
Tortoise.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.